from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A big presidential push yesterday in Washington for family-friendly work policies, as President Obama put it. Flex time, paid maternity leave, paternity leave, more accommodating workplaces with policies more realistically attuned to family needs. Can we do it? And why does the U.S. lag? This hour on Point, family-friendly work schedules and flexibility in today's American workplace. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is your workplace flexible, family-friendly? What's it do or not do? How's it working? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We start in Washington, where the President, First Lady, and Vice President Joe Biden all turned out for what was billed as a Working Families Summit yesterday. Edward Isaac Dover is Senior White House Reporter for Politico. Isaac, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What was the agenda yesterday, sir?
Well, the main thing that the White House was trying to do was get the national conversation jump-started about the way that work life has not caught up to the way that family life has changed over the last couple of decades. So what they were doing was talking about the policies that they think need to be put in place to have women able to have pregnancy leave that is more accommodating, or even just workplace conditions that are more accommodating when they're pregnant, to childcare, when they go back to work, or child care for men, flexible hours, telecommuting, all those sorts of things that they say is a necessary part of society catching up to the fact that work life hasn't changed all that much over the last couple of decades, even as two parents are usually now working and other changes have happened in the home.
Was it a day of cheerleading for these kind of steps, or were there steps taken or announced, actual moves yesterday?
Well, like, this is the year of action, the president said, but there's actually not all that much that he could do in his year of action, even limited as that year of action is when he talks about executive authority. So he did put forward some conversational things about what people should be talking about, beyond that, had a presidential memorandum that he put forward to have the federal government look at things that the government should be doing to accommodate child care and pregnancy and those sorts of things. But even within the very limited scope of effect that his year of action has had on other things, this was even more limited than that.
And yet, people know what he's talking about. Anybody with a family and a couple of jobs in a household knows how tough it can be. Isaac Dover, here's the president just a little bit at the summit yesterday on working families, saying that parents who are struggling to balance work and family should not feel like they're alone in that struggle.
These problems are not typically the result of poor planning or too little diligence on the parts of moms or dads, and they cannot just be fixed by working harder or being an even better parent. All too often, they are the result of outdated policies and old ways of thinking. Family leave, child care, workplace flexibility, a decent wage, these are not frills, they are basic needs. They shouldn't be bonuses, they should be part of our bottom line as a society. That's what we're striving towards.
The president yesterday at a Working Families Summit, pretty big crowd there. Who was there, Isaac?
Well, it was a crowd of mostly key and core supporters of the president. This was something that was billed as an official White House event, although it really did feel at points like a campaign event, including during the president's remarks when he talked about how much trouble he was having getting things through Congress. And some people in the crowd started to hiss and boo, and he said a line that he always says on the trail, which is "Don't boo, vote." So it did have that campaign aspect to it, which is important for the Democrats because they're looking to make this year and the midterm argument very much about an appeal to women and focus on things like paid family leave in the summit, but also equal pay and raising the minimum wage, which the administration says would affect women disproportionately.
Though the president was keen to say yesterday this was not just a women's issue, but certainly politics come in right there. Edward Isaac DeVere covers the White House for Politico, senior White House reporter there. Isaac, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Here's the president in an interview with CNN yesterday saying it's not just a women's issue.
This is not just a women's issue. One of the most precious memories that I'll ever have is when my first daughter, Malia, was born. I was lucky enough that my schedule allowed me to take that first month off and, you know, staying up at 2 in the morning and feeding her and burping her and, you know, creates a bond that is irreplaceable. And a lot of companies are already doing it, and it's working.
The president with personal memories there of early fatherhood experiences, not available to everybody, all different degrees of workplace flexibility around this country and in different companies. Let's look at what's really going on in the American workplace. We'd love to hear from you. 800-423-8255. Joining me now from Orlando, Florida, is Ellen Galinsky, president, co-founder of the Families and Work Institute nonprofit research organization, looks at changes in work and family life. She co-directs the National Study of the Changing Workforce and National Study of Employers, as well as the program When Work Works. It's a project on workplace flexibility. She was at the summit yesterday. Ellen Galinsky, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And with me in the studio is Lottie Balin, professor of management emerita at the MIT Sloan School of Management, studies the relationship between managerial practice and employees' lives, dynamics of gender and diversity. Lottie Balin, wonderful to have you right here.
Thank you, Tom.
Ellen, I'm looking at these charts of American law and policy on family-friendly policies, and they're just kind of incredible, at least among developed nations, how deeply at the bottom of the list the United States is. What and when you look at maternity leave, I'm looking here at a study that found in the entire world, not just developed world, only three countries don't require it: Oman, Papua New Guinea, and the United States. Why has this country lagged when it comes to more flexible workplace law and policy, Ellen?
We have assumed that managing your work and family life is either a personal responsibility, as the president said yesterday, or increasingly we've assumed that it's a business responsibility and not a societal or governmental or shared responsibility. So it's deeply embedded in the Americans' psyche. And even when we passed the Family and Medical Leave Act in 1993, that bill had been posed for many years, 8 years. And there was very strong opposition because it was believed that it would hurt business, particularly small business. It didn't turn out to. That's not true, but that again is a strongly held belief. But yesterday, I think, was really quite different in that I was listening to the report before. It was not just a Democratic rally or the president's supporters. I know that we, the Families and Work Institute, were able to invite employers, and we invited about 60 employers, most of whom came, and they represented small, mid-sized, and large companies, not just about paid legislation, but also about what they were doing as employers. So I think it was unusual in two respects, the summit. One was that the groups that typically have competitive issues like increasing the minimum wage or leave or sick days or discrimination or domestic violence, et cetera, were all there with a shared vision for working families. And although there weren't as many employers in the room as there were in the 2010 Summit on Workplace Flexibility, which I helped plan and participated in as well, there were the groups were very diverse and more together than I've ever heard in wanting to change things from different vantage points, but to change things for working families.
CEOs of Goldman Sachs, Johnson & Johnson,
right.
Shake Shack at the conference yesterday.
Yes, I heard them speak yesterday.
Lottie Balin, you've been watching this for a long time. It would appear that American resistance is somehow deep, that people are adopting these policies, but yet not in the same degree as we see abroad. What do you think it is about the United States that puts us in that posture?
I think we have such an individualistic sense about how we should live, how we should bring up our families. Children in this country are not seen as a social good. At the sort of higher income level, people are expected, if they're going to have children, it's their individual responsibility, and they better know how to take care of them. Ironically, at the very lower level, we expect people who have children to also work, and yet we don't provide them at all with the supports they need, child care, or indeed good jobs that would allow them to provide this themselves.
40%, I'm reading here, of private sector employees, 40% work at a company that does not offer sick pay for illness or injury, not one day. Lottie Balin, please stand by. We've got much more to look at here. Ellen Galinsky in Orlando. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about flex time, parental leave, and the new White House call for family-friendly work schedules and policies. Eleanor Galinsky joins us, president and co-founder of the Families and Work Institute, with us today from Orlando, Florida. With me in the studio, Lottie Balin, professor of management emerita at the MIT Sloan School of Management. You can hear the voices all over this country wrestling with this. It is not easy. It's especially not easy in the United States. Here's a little bit from Family Values at Work. It's an outfit that promotes more accommodating family-friendly policies. Talking with a single mom of a 10-year-old, Alex, who's autistic, describing what happened when she couldn't find backup care for her son when the Chicago Public Schools closed because of a sub-zero temperatures last winter. She called her employer.
The night before, I called and let them know. I literally had no one to watch my son. Or pay to watch my son. And I couldn't make my shift. And the next day, they called me and told me that I abused the attendance policy, and so they let me go.
You know, even without the piano music, that's a heart-wrenching story. And lots of Americans face that in their workplace when they try to do something about it. Here's Kara Schultz, managing editor at PNC News, talking with HuffPost Live not long ago about her personal experiences with flex time in the workplace.
My direct supervisor, who is a female, was very hardcore on that and would talk to other women and tell them, you know, don't do this. Don't ask for this. It's a career ender. Looks bad. But even looking at that years later in a different job, there was that same type of dynamic. So there really wasn't a change in view.
Don't do this. Don't ask for this. It's a career ender. It looks bad. Ellen Galinsky, have attitudes not changed more than that in this country? If people even simply ask for flex time?
Actually, no. The Families and Work Institute, does a nationally representative study of the U.S. workforce. We've done it since 1992. We're building on a 1977 study. We have seen that the perception that there will be jeopardy if you ask for the flexibility that your employer offers will really hurt you, and that stated about 2 in 5 employees. It's been flatlined. It hasn't changed at all. We're just about to go out in the field again, so we'll see if there's a change, but that hasn't changed. We have seen flexibility increase. We also do a study of employers, a national study of employers, and we've seen that there's more flexibility around full-time work, so that's jumped up despite the well-discussed case at Yahoo or Best Buy. We've seen that flexibility, for example, for allowing employees to work some of their regular hours at home has jumped from 50% to 67%. But flexibility around spending any extended time away from work, either it's part-time work or leaves or those sorts of things, that's gone down. So there's a pretty mixed picture, good news, bad news picture in terms of what employers are offering.
Lottie Bailyn, the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, responded to the White House summit and said in a statement that the trouble is too many middle-class families aren't working at all. The kind of suggestion there, and this has been around a long time, if you go for these policies, you may actually hurt job creation overall. We may lose jobs. What do economic studies show about the relationship between flex time, family-friendly work policies, and overall economic health, job numbers?
I think there's no evidence that it has anything to do with losing jobs. But as Ellen said, there still tends to be a flexibility stigma. And part of that is the way that flexibility arrangements are actually done in companies, the way the policies are implemented. They tend to be implemented by a negotiation between a single employee and a supervisor, and that leads to the kinds of stigmas and fears.
Or resentment from other employees.
Resentment. Mm-hmm. And in the work that we've done, and there are other examples, if you have work groups collectively as a group set their schedules with the goal that the work has to get done, then you don't have those, and the flexibility policies can actually be implemented to the benefit not only of the employees, but even of the way that work is getting done of that group. So if done correctly, it can actually be a win-win situation, not a loss for the employers.
A lot of listeners calling in here. Let's begin to bring them in. Green Bay, Wisconsin. Katie's calling. Hi, Katie. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was calling just to make a comment. This topic is very, it hits close to home for me. I had a child last summer, and I was off of work for my FMLA, and it came time to go back to work, and I felt for me and my family, it wasn't right for me to be gone 40-plus hours a week with my husband. He has a very hectic work schedule. It just wasn't right for our family. Mm-hmm. I went to my employer, talked to them about it, asked if there was a part-time option, and they said no, so I left the workplace. And, you know, I'm educated. I went to school. I've got a bachelor's and a master's degree. I worked really hard to get where I was professionally, and, you know, I'm sad about leaving the workplace.
What did you ask for, Katie, so we can understand a little better? How much flexibility did you propose?
I wanted to work about 20 to 25 hours a week, so about 3 days a week.
Mm-hmm. And their response was what?
No, we can't do that.
Because?
Because my position was a full-time 40-plus hour per week position.
And that was that end of conversation, and you left?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Lottie Bailyn, what do you think of this story? But, of course, that might require somebody else being pregnant at the same time or, I don't know, needing this.
One of the problems is that employers don't necessarily want to divide the benefit line. The caller's story follows the trends. Our data show that in 2008, 41% of employers allowed flexible part-time work, and it's dropped to 36%. Lottie was talking about job shares, and that's dropped from 29% to 18%. In a tough economy, the employers have not understood the economic benefits and have cut back on reduced time, which is too bad because, as everyone knows, and Michelle Obama yesterday told this story of working part-time and giving much more than the hours that you're paid for. So employers do benefit from this just because they get they get people who are well educated or who know their jobs and who give a lot more because they're really glad that they can both have a family and care for their family the way that they want to and continue to provide for their family economically.
Those falling numbers on flexibility are very striking. I want to test this, the economic case here. The president made the case yesterday that it was important for companies and for the country to bring in more family-friendly policies, that it made the United States more competitive. Let's listen and we'll test his theory of the case. Here's the president.
Our economy demands them because it's going to help us compete. It's going to help us lead. And that means paid family leave, especially paid parental leave. There is only one developed country in the world that does not offer paid maternity leave, and that is us. And that is not the list you want to be on by your lonesome. It's time to change that, because all Americans should be able to afford to care for their families.
Ellen, you were there. Lots of enthusiasm for that right there. And I must say, it remains very striking that the United States stands all alone among developed countries and in the world, only the U.S., Oman, and Papua New Guinea not guaranteeing paid maternity leave. But what about the idea here, Lottie, that this is important for national competitiveness? Does that hold up to scrutiny?
Absolutely. Our caller, the company lost the benefits of her work. They had to replace her. There are turnover costs. I mean, it was a real loss for the company, and you multiply that hundreds of times. You are losing good people who have been trained, who know their job. You have to pay to retrain other people, and you're not going to be as competitive if you spread that around all the companies in this country.
Ellen, I'm looking down this list. It's just stunning. This is developed countries and, length paid maternity leave. Required, and it's Sweden, Denmark, Portugal, Finland, Norway, France, and we've got 14 weeks, 18 weeks, 17 weeks, 35 weeks, 16 weeks. When you get down to the UK, which is hardly a foreign culture, and it's 52 weeks, Australia, 52 weeks. It's kind of amazing, given how women have flooded into the workforce for decades now, Ellen, that this hasn't been made an issue in the United States, an effectively addressed issue.
Well, I think it has been made an issue. I mean, Michelle Obama yesterday said this is the beginning of a new movement, and I looked around the room, and there are people like Lottie and like me and like Kathleen Christensen from the Sloan Foundation and so many others who have been working, Ellen Bravo, you mentioned her, who have been working either to improve or both to improve.
But the number I'm staring at on this chart has the United States, number of weeks paid maternity leave, zero, and it's all alone.
On it. I mean, as Lottie said, we have deeply entrenched values that put it at odds with competitiveness, even though the research shows otherwise. Families and Work Institute gives an award called When Work Works, and it's for companies that have created policies around what we call an effective workplace that improve things for both the employer and the employee. We have 5,000 employers that have applied since we started this award about 10 years ago. And so there are lots of exceptions, but they're exceptions. So, we are quite different.
Yes, we really stand out with those double zeros. Tim in Omaha, Nebraska. Tim, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just had a quick question. First of all, I am not at all opposed to the idea of paid maternity leave and family-friendly work environments, but there has to be a cost associated with it. And my question was, where would that money come from, and what would the effect be on, if not hiring, wages then?
If not hiring, what do you mean by the wage question, Tim? How would that come in? Help me out.
Just in that... could it have a negative effect on hourly wages?
Oh, I see, on overall wages, because to pay for these policies, you might have to cut back on overall wages. Lottie Balin, what about Tim's question? How do small businesses, let's say, pay for this if they embrace it?
I think that's a real issue. I would, in a way, like to turn it around. Mm-hmm. What is the cost of not doing this? How do we, what are the health costs of people working more than they want to? What are the costs to how we're bringing up our children if they're not under good care? What are the costs of losing people who have to opt out because they're not given? Those are harder costs to do, but I bet if we could really do that economic analysis, including the costs of not doing it, and of course he's right, there are some costs of doing it, mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised if the costs of not doing it are actually higher.
Ellen Galinsky, we think of employers over time as rational actors. If it's less expensive to be more flexible, why wouldn't it be happening?
Well, I think it is happening. Here's, in terms of the question about the costs, when the Family and Medical Leave Act was first introduced, there was a huge fear that it would hurt small business. That's why the exemption level is at 50. We did a study of the states that had offered. There were more than half the states that had passed laws before we passed the federal law, and we did a study. We're a nonpartisan, non-advocacy mm-hmm. research group.
Yep.
We did a study of what happened in the states, and in fact, even if they had lower exemption levels, it didn't hurt the employer. The three states that have a paid leave right now pay for it through an employee set aside, so it's not the employer's paying for it. And there are five states that have temporary disability insurance that pays people for a heart attack or a broken leg.
And which are the three? Which are the three you mentioned with paid maternity?
The states that have passed leave. Well, Washington State has passed it, but it hasn't gone to an effect.
Yep.
California has passed it. New Jersey has passed it. And is it Connecticut, Lottie? I'm not remembering, but Connecticut or Rhode Island just passed it.
Okay. Lorraine in Charleston, South Carolina. Lorraine, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm well. What do you know?
Well, I just wanted to say I work for, we'll just say corporate America.
Okay.
I'm a professional.
Yeah.
I get full benefits. However, I get 5 days off a year. That's it.
Is that vacation or sick leave or what is that, those 5 days?
That's whatever you want to call it.
Just five, period.
PTO.
Okay.
Five days. That's it. I'm a single mom, and in order to produce what they want me to produce, what is expected, I need to work in between 50 and 60 hours a week. So most nights I'm putting my daughter to bed and I'm going back to work. I work from home.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is great. However, you know, I am in my office 50 or 60 hours a week.
50 to 60 hours a week, 5 days off per year, no matter what, a single mom. I mean, Lorraine, that sounds like a pretty tough treadmill.
It is. It absolutely is. I just keep on plugging away, though. I have to do what you have to do. It's a hard job market right now. So this is what I do, and I've been doing this right now at this pace for about 4 years.
You and a whole lot of others up against a tough job market. We wish you luck with that, Lorraine. I mean, Lottie, that's just
terrible.
That is a rough life.
And again, it shows some U.S. assumptions that the more time you put in, the more productive you are. We have research that shows that that is not true, that time away from work is very important in order to be creative and innovative, that these long hours lead to rigidities, lead to mistakes, lead to burnout, and you're losing the productive value of your people by putting them through this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about flex time, parental leave, and the new White House call for family-friendly work schedules and more. Lottie Balin is with us from the MIT Sloan School of Management. Ellen Galinsky is here, president and co-founder of Families and Work Institute. All kinds of response online here. Ashley says, hey, my current job offers zero benefits, zero paid time off, and the small business she works for makes probably close to $1 million or more a year. Okay. But there's another attitude out here as well. Here's a listener who says, I wanted a car. I paid for it myself. I needed a job. I looked for it myself. I wanted a college degree. I put in my own sweat equity. I wanted a secure country. I went served in the armed forces. You want a kid? Work it out for yourself. There's a hard line online. Let me bring in a human resources voice in here with a lot of experience balancing all these needs. Danica Davis is with us from San Francisco, CEO of the Northern California Human Resources Association. She's worked in HR since 1990. That's a lot of experience. Danica, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be here.
When you hear the kind of call we heard out of the White House yesterday for a whole buffet of more family-friendly policies, as an HR person, do you say, bring them on? Or are you thinking, oh, no, what are we going to do if these become law?
You know, probably a little bit of both. The issue isn't around the concept. I think that very few employers, and particularly HR people, who balance between achieving organizational objectives and being actual advocates for employees, not against family-friendly policies. And I think there's a pretty big divide between a discussion around flexibility, which most employers, I happen to work in San Francisco, have embraced quite some time ago, mm-hmm. although that's fairly concentrated in the areas of knowledge or traditional office work, leaving an awful lot of working families out, and then mandated paid leave. I think where employers perhaps get their back up or you start saying the oh no part of this is expansions of mandatory paid benefits.
When you look at, you must have seen these lists of other developed countries. I mean, it is all of them, essentially, which offer a lot more mandated leave than the United States. What do you make of those? Is it bewildering to you how they do it? 14 weeks, 18 weeks, 52 weeks, 35 weeks, or, I mean, we compete with them. You must see companies who go right up against Norwegian companies and Swiss companies. They somehow compete.
Agreed. And as was pointed out, California has had paid maternity leave or personal leave funded by employees. Mm-hmm. So there's one solution that's working in California. And then San Francisco itself has mandated paid sick leave, and businesses adapted. They found ways to manage their workplaces and to continue to compete for talent. I think that this is a pocket within our country, and that perhaps is where it's breaking down, that people and the general business community don't see how they do it in these other countries. And until there's a clear path defined, there's just going to be blanket resistance.
Danica, please stand by. Let me go to our listeners again. Elizabeth in Newton, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Elizabeth. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I work at a university in the Boston area,
okay.
And I'm a single mother with three sons. Mm-hmm. They're older, 25, 20, and 16, but I get really good benefits, and I appreciate that. And even I used to work in corporate America. I got good benefits there, but I still feel like at a certain point, I'm on the mommy track. I'm definitely not getting, you know, the kinds of positions that men my age with the same amount of kids are getting. And the fact that I have to be able to, you know, jump out since I'm a single mother and I'm the only one, you know, taking care of my kids. I need to jump out sometimes to go to the doctor or something.
Yep.
And or perhaps pick a son up from college when his, you know,
yeah.
ride fell through, that kind of thing. And
yeah.
And I do feel like I get penalized, and I work probably 50, 60 hours a week, you know, and it's flex time, but I still, it's more nuanced, you know, it's
yes.
not like I don't get anything, but I still am frustrated and you know, I feel like that I'm not working at my best, and they're not getting the best out of me.
That's so interesting, because you're saying the hours you put in the same, or who knows, more, but the need for some flexibility itself can produce a stigma. A lot of you have watched this for a long time. What about that pattern? Is
well,
it there?
It certainly has been shown that there is a mother penalty. If you send out two CVs to employers, everything the same except there's something that says you belong to the PTA or
mm-hmm,
something like
mm-hmm.
that.
The mommy signal.
The difference in callbacks is enormous. There is, so the ones with the PTA will much less likely to get called back than the others. Now, there is, from the legal profession, the Hastings Law School, Joan Williams, is beginning to legislate some of this as family discrimination, that this is actually so that may begin to have a little bit of say, because if employers begin to lose suits on this, then they may pay more attention. But I'm afraid the caller is correct. There, we have demonstrated there is a mother penalty, and we need to try to do everything we can to get around that.
Danica, in California, do you see this in your work in HR? Do you have people coming in and saying, hey, you know, thanks for the bennies, but I feel like it's creating a headwind for me?
Absolutely. I mean, there are some firms that actually recruit by having family-friendly work environments. So it's an advantage to them to have found ways to make their policies more family-friendly. I think it was mentioned earlier, however, that there's another side to that coin, is that when you are creating policies that seem to be advantageous to those who choose to have families, there can be these underlying currents or nuances of resentment from those that have chosen not to have families.
Could I respond here?
Yes, please, Ellen.
Well, first I want to say that I'm in Orlando because it's the annual conference of the Society for Human Resource Management, and I'm speaking in it, and we're a partner of SHRM, because they believe in these policies for employers to institute so strongly that they've made it one of their three major focuses. We've talked a lot about this as being family-friendly or not just for women. But in fact, I think there's going to be a change because of men. We find in our research that men are experiencing more work-life conflict these days than women are, and young men want the kind of lives that a number of your callers are talking about. Whether they're single parents raising children as men, or whether they're in dual earner families, they want to go to that ball game or that doctor's appointment. And then I also want to mention elder care. This isn't just about children. This is about our aging parents. And our research shows that one in two of us has had elder care responsibility in the last 5 years, and expect to in the coming years. And we may choose to have children, but we don't choose to have parents.
You can get pinched from both ends right there.
Yeah, so this is a universal issue, and I think we still talk about it in a veiled way as a women's issue, and it does, of course, affect women more. But I think that is changing with men.
And maybe a kind of generational shift there as well. We'll look at that. Pete in New Orleans. Pete, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
You know, all the focus is on women's relationships with the business, but what about the employees that are left behind when somebody takes a leave? I've had that happen to me, and that certainly affects my family life because it means more overtime and, you know, a lot more hours put in while we scramble to find a replacement. So,
yeah, was that a personal issue or kind of a general issue in your office, Pete?
Well, I'm retired now. Fortunately, part of the reason I'm retired is I had to work so hard to fill up the gap sometimes, take up the slack. And, you know, everybody's thinking about how the business is affected, but it's the people in the business, the employees, that are really affected more than anybody. I hope that some of that would be taken into consideration when we start passing bills.
Yes, Pete, I appreciate your call from New Orleans. Let us pick it up. Danica, here's another along that line online. Kyle says, not sure why people who choose not to have children should be on the losing end of these policies. Why can't I have a 52-week paid sabbatical to engage in whatever I want to do that doesn't involve having kids? And there's Pete in New Orleans who says he's had the experience of having to pick up the slack, and it cost his family. What about that challenge, Danica?
Well, it's about balancing needs, the needs of the business to the individual, and then the needs of the individuals within that business. That's what I was alluding to earlier. And as Ellen points out, this isn't just a child care issue or paid maternity leave.
Mm-hmm.
We've had to accommodate leaves under FMLA. There are regulatory requirements under the Disability Act. So many employers would actually like to take things on a case-by-case basis, perhaps. But the regulatory environments, while we're looking at regulatory and perhaps more fairness or flexibility, some of the laws are in conflict with those. So, for example, in California, flexibility is significantly decreased because of daily overtime rules. You just can't have people making up time or what have you. And what the caller points out is a reality. So conceptually, everyone agrees with more flexibility. I've never met an HR person or a business owner that didn't want to do the right thing. And the reality is that you grant some of these leaves and folks come in and say, yeah, but what about me? It's a bit of the Me Too syndrome.
I would love to respond to that. And Lottie talked about it before earlier. I think as we move away from the notion of the individual contributor and we move more toward a focus on teams, that this is something that teams need to work out, because all of us will need some flexibility, whatever our life situation, whatever our age, whatever our job status. And when it's not just the individual and the supervisor, or winning the boss lottery, as they were talking about yesterday, when we can see this as a team responsibility, where the people aren't one person isn't having to make up for another person being away solely, but the work is divided in a way that's more equitable and doesn't burn out the people who are still there, then I think we're going to come a long way toward resolving these issues in ways that work for the employer and the employee.
Of course, that requires a team culture that may not exist in a lot of corporate settings or employment settings. Geer in Bridgehampton, New York. Geer, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Yeah, I live in Bridgehampton, New York, and I lived in the States now for 15 years, but I'm from Iceland originally and born in Norway and was raised there as well.
Okay.
And in Iceland, we have both extended maternity leave and paternity leave, as that's extremely important as well. And it's recognized by society how important it is, essentially, to take care of, you know, the mothers are bringing in the next generation that's going to take over our country. And to leave them on the back burner is just irresponsible.
So when, as a Norwegian become Icelander, become American resident, what do you see in the culture here, Geir?
I think, one of your previous callers, some have been commenting about what about me, but it's again, you know, once you integrate such a system into society, it's just expected and understood, and people pitch in, and it doesn't affect the workplace so much because you're used to these rotations and people know how to compensate for them.
Yeah, Geir, I appreciate your call so much. Lottie, I wonder how that gets introduced. Yeah, we talked about individualism very early in this hour, and definitely that's in the United States. But I've experienced what Geir is talking about in other countries, that just presumption that there will be accommodations made because, as Geir says, it is the next generation. But still, we start where we start.
Right. But on the other hand, as Ellen has already suggested, companies are really moving to teamwork because they realize how much interdependence there is in the tasks that they have to do. And in fact, it's that interdependence that can give you a way out, that you can reorganize the work in such a way that, say, everybody has a primary job but also a secondary task that they're responsible for, so that if someone is out, the secondary person can sort of take over. And if you organize your work in some way like that, then you can actually be more effective in getting the work done while at the same time allowing people more flexibility in moving in and out of when they do their work.
Maybe a new generation where fathers expect to be more involved in parenting, sure, may be pushing for that. One more call. Our time is short, but Brandy in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Brandy, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm okay. What do you see, Brandy?
Well, I kind of want to address the issue of childcare in lower-income families. Those people that are making, you know, minimum wage to $10, $11 an hour, you know, you've got proper childcare that costs, you know, between $5 and $6 an hour. And those of us that are going out and working for, you know, $10 an hour after the day is done, we're only making, you know, $3 or $4 an hour. So, you know, that's really hard. You know, sometimes it's just easier to just stay home. And I hate to say that, but, you know, a lot of people are, you know, there's a great majority of the country that is really facing that problem, you know, and I'm a small business owner. So, you know, I see it every day. You know, the people that work for me, they come in and they work their butts off. But at the end of the day, they're giving, you know, all of their money to somebody to watch their kids, which, you know,
Yeah, that's pretty tough. And that in an area where you can get childcare for $5 or $6 an hour, big parts of the country would be overjoyed to have that. But if you're making 10 out of your take home, I mean, Lottie, that's just about all of it for a lot of people. We've only got a minute, but this is an enormous issue, that huge chunk of our society making near the minimum wage and childcare simply unaffordable.
I mean, that's the irony of what has happened in this country. By not taking children as a social good, we don't provide for the care, yet we expect these low-income mothers to work. And that's not going to be...
And we depend on their kids to grow up and be reading and be contributing members of the society.
And that's not a sustainable situation. I mean, we either have to provide more income support for those mothers to be able to take care of their children themselves, and fathers if they're in the situation, or we have to provide decent childcare.
Ellen, we've just got half a minute. Do you see further change coming here, or will we have the same conversation 10 years from now?
Yesterday, the U.S. Conference of Mayors passed unanimously, so bipartisan, a resolution to create an early learning nation, asking all of the mayors to do something in their own communities to take what we know from brain science and try to promote better learning environments. We have 31 states where child care costs more on average than the in-state college tuition. I think that the resolution of the mayors indicates that hopefully change is coming.
Ellen Galinsky at the Families and Work Institute. Ellen, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Danica Davis in the Northern California Human Resources Association. Thank you, Danica. And Lottie Balin from the Sloan School at MIT. Thanks so much to all.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.